Hi, and welcome to Steve Race True Crime Interviews. And delighted to be joined by the Lost Soldier, as he's known, Rich. How are you, mate?
I'm good, Steve. I'm all right. I'm okay. Hanging in there.
Well, that's good. That's good. And you've got a fantastic story to tell. And it's available in a book called Charlie 4 Kilo, which you can buy on Amazon. The link is below. It's by Rich Jones, your good self. And what a story it is. And, you know, any other links, you'll find them below. Make sure you click on it. Make sure you buy the book. It's available as a paperback and available as a Kindle. But let's go back to the start, Rich. Tell us a little bit about where you were born, what your childhood was like.
So, born in Bristol, accent. So we've got a language barrier straight away, but I can understand you. I came from I consider a good background, a loving background. Father was in the police force. You know, he's an old school copper from back in the day in the 70s and the 80s. I grew up in it was decent. It was really decent. And then I come 14, my parents divorced, and that really shattered my vision of the perfect world. I'm not blaming them because these things do happen. You know, it's common, but it kind of gave me a lack of direction, because once I saw my mum had left and my dad was in custody, and it was the right choice at the right time. My dad did his best to bring up my brother and I, but I think I was always destined to be a little bit naughty. So I took advantage of a bad situation. You know, I didn't really focus on school as much as I should have done. You know, I didn't really focus on a career. I had no idea where to go with a career. This was back in this happened in 84. I was due to leave school in 86. And as you'll know, as some of the people listening will know, that back in those days, there was no real direction in what vocation. If you're a guy, you're going to work on a site or do something manual. If you're a girl, you're going to go and be a hairdresser or be a cook or be a mum. And that's about it. That was your options. You know, only just by then were they bringing in work with computers. Yeah, but the computer work in our school, someone stole the computer. So that class was all finished. So they were gone. It was known as the BBC computers we had. There's a massive scandal about the theft of all these computers in the school. We don't know who took them to this day, but it kind of ruined our future because we could have gone down that route. So I was kind of really bouncing between jobs from 16, and I just really wasn't getting into it. I wasn't feeling it. I wasn't feeling these sort of random generic jobs, if you like. So I thought, yeah, I've been getting in trouble, and I thought, if I don't do something about this soon, I'm gonna end up in prison. Hindsight. So I opted to join the army at 18.
Wow. I mean, that's a big jump. And I mean, a lot of people do that, and I've discussed this with a few other interviewees on the show. I mean, I got a little bit wayward in my late teens. Got to 20, 21, was having, messing around with drink and, messing around with girls as you do at that age. And ultimately, I was going down the wrong track. And, I ended up having a set to with my dad. But I decided to turn my life around. And I, rather than going into the full-time military, chose to go into the TA, which I know is frowned upon by the regular military. But I felt that I needed some kind of discipline, a short, sharp shock in my life. And I went into it. And is that what made you do that, or was it just simply a career choice for you?
I wasn't thinking, mate. I just was not thinking. See, I think what I thought was, let's just find somewhere to get some respite from the life I've got. I didn't even intend to really progress into the army. I just thought, let's just go and do some training. Let's apply for the forces and let's just roll the dice and see where it goes. I didn't have any career plan. I just kind of went in. I think I just blindly just followed this path into the forces, and it was the right choice. I mean, in hindsight, I think the TA would have been great, but I don't think it would have taken me away from the element of the people that I was hanging around with at the time. It wouldn't have distanced me enough from the problems that I was potentially going to be facing, or the people that I was going to be facing these problems with. So I think joining up, shoot, because it was a standard practice. You're going to go to Germany. If you join up in the 80s, you go into Germany, simple as that. Unless you're, a particular unit, you might be in somewhere different. But chances are you're going to be in the Cold War over in West Germany. That's going to be it, and that was going to be far enough away from my life in England for me to really sort of sever those ties and make something of my life. And I always knew that. I guess my grandfather was in the tank regiment, and he died when I was 15. So I think part of me maybe wanted to do something which was right for a change. And joining the tank is some, it made perfect sense. And there he is with hair. you threw that one on me.
Good picture, though. Good picture. Takes you back, I guess, when you look at that. I mean, what were the first few weeks like? I mean, you do your basic training. I mean, I presume, Rich, you were physically fit.
No, I didn't prepare for it at all, mate. I was.
Oh no! So you were going into that like
I went in completely unprepared. I was in bits. I literally think I'm going to join the army, and that was it. It was kind of, have you seen that film Stripes from years ago with Bill Murray? And you know where they just go in completely clueless? That was me. That was me. I just went in. I wasn't unfit. I just wasn't mentally or physically ready for that kind of exposure, and it hit me hard. Every day was hard going. I mean, it wasn't a day didn't go by where I thought, oh, God, this is hard graft. But I did it. I got through it. And it was back in the days where bullying was acceptable. Bullying was allowed. People were allowed to hit you if you're on parade. If you got it wrong, you'd get a slap. Yeah, and so you grew up with that kind of mentality in your unit. And that carried through. But I think basic was 8 weeks of pure hell. But the thing is with that, when you're up against it and you've got so many, I guess, so many challenges you're trying to rise to, and the people in charge of you, maybe just not much older than you, but these are they're promoted. These people are like gods to you. If they shout, you literally cower at what they're going to say. But you have these moments when everything's so bad, then you get these little moments of serenity when everything is just suddenly, you know, something funny happens. And it might not be that funny, but at that time, because everything else is so bad, it seems really funny. And you get the proper belly laughter. And when you try not to laugh, so you get these moments in basic where if you could be on a parade in the barracks, in the block, all stood up in a long, thin corridor, 29 of you, and you know you're in for trouble. And then someone just, and one of the training staff gets right up in your face and they're touching your nose and you know they're trying to make you giggle. And as soon as someone gives it, you're all off, you're gone. And they're laughing so much, even the four screws and the latches, they're laughing as well. Looking back on that, it wasn't funny, but at the time, you get these moments where you suddenly realize that this is dark humor. This is where it's born. You're in this really dark, difficult place, facing all kinds of odds, and you're laughing. And that laughter seems so precious. And that's what kind of keeps you going a little bit, especially through basic and into your unit. But yeah,
what did you find? What was the hardest thing that you found? I mean, for me, I found the drill boring. I found it, you know, the days were long as well. I think it was something like 16-hour days, because obviously they try to replicate, you know, your basic training when you first go into the TA. And it was just, I mean, I didn't have the best mindset for cross country and stuff like that. And you had to do a 3-mile course of the barracks. I think it was Catterick we were at, and we had to do this 3-mile course. And the first one was fine. I came under the allotted time. The second one, though, when it's the same course, and after you've done some battle training or you've done some weapon training or whatever, the second one was harder and it was a slower time. The third one, which was at the end of nearly a 16-hour day, I was shattered, absolutely shattered, and it mentally broke me down. And I knew I knew I wasn't going to come round. And it was little things like something which was probably a really small incline felt like it felt like going up Ben Nevis on that last 16th hour. And I was shocked. It wasn't for me. And I couldn't take the discipline as well. The Sergeant Major clearly didn't like me. and I started having a pop back at him and he didn't like that. And it just wasn't for me. But what was the hardest part for you?
Well, Catterick is where I trained. And the BFT is what you referred to as your 3-miler. You know, 1.5 miles squatted, 1.5 miles best effort. And it's to the cattle grid. I don't know if you did that, but anyone who's been trained at Catterick in the last 30 years, the cattle grid was your turning point. It was hard graft. I mean, what I found hardest, I think, was the fitness. Mm. So I wasn't ready for it. And the hardest bit I found in the fitness was the combat fitness test, the CFT. 8 miles, fully kitted up in less than 2 hours. That doesn't sound much, but when you're already physically drained and physically tired, and you've got blisters and your body aches, you've had jabs in your arms, you're taking so many inoculations, your arms hurt, you can't move. And now you've got to run these 8 miles. I'd never ran 8 miles. I didn't even know what 8 miles looked like, up and down. And Catterick's harsh. The environment can be harsh. It could be red hot, it could be freezing cold, but it's not smooth terrain. I find the CFT really hard. Drill I found okay, but that's because everyone else is doing it. And we're armored corps. We're not known for being drill picks. We're not the best. We're pretty slack when it comes to drill, even more so when we get to our unit. But I just find that I think the CFC, the high-end fitness, I really struggle with at that time. So I wasn't aware of this thing called a second breath or a second wind. I just felt when I was getting out of breath after the first, say, mile, I thought, I'm done for. That's it. I've run out of steam. I'm done for. So I'd be thinking, my head's beginning to switch off. And I'm thinking, why are these guys all okay? And I discovered it when I got to my unit that you run through it, you push through that bar, and then you just go. You just keep on going. And that's what I found is the mentality is I needed that switch. I didn't find that switch during training, but I found it when I got to the unit. And that's what I found hard was mentally trying to address the levels of fitness that were required of me for doing no prep whatsoever. So anyone going to join up, just do your prep, plenty of it.
It's as simple as that, really.
Yeah, so, really.
So you obviously stuck with it. Where was your first posting?
So straight out to Germany, a little place called Hamer, which if anyone knows Hamer, they won't do. Play near a place called Dortmund, which is the biggest town near Hamer. And that's kind of really central Germany, if you like. Bear in mind, this is when we had the East and the West. So we're over there with another 55,000 British troops in the BAOR, and we provided this contingency for NATO against the old Warsaw Pact, which is Russia, what used to be Poland, and everything else over on the eastern side. And that was it. It was there. And I just assumed, foolishly, that we're going to get to this base, and that's going to be it for the next however many years I stay in. And we did a blast in Northern Ireland, which is that photograph you showed just now. That was in me in Northern Ireland. That was in Armagh, in the Bandit country. That I really enjoyed, not because of the political side of it, not because I was over doing a job which some may or may not agree with. It was because I enjoyed the fact that I was doing something dangerous and there was an element of risk. I was doing the job I was paid to be in to do, just for a change. Rather than sitting around in the naffy drinking, we did something which meant something to us. We're actually on operational tours. That's why you join the army, to go and do something. I wasn't expecting it, and I really enjoyed the fact that I was in an area which I could potentially be shot, blown up. There was a few cliches, but you know, I walked away from that and I had this little thing in my head thinking, I really enjoyed that. I'd love to do more of that, you know, and that's something that triggered a risk, I guess, a sense of risk-taking behavior, which was in me. And I just kind of pursued that element of risk, if you like.
What do you mean by risk-taking behavior? Because I've seen this, obviously, takes a big part of your, you know, it's a big part of your book, but also, you know, the stuff that you go out and talk about now.
Yeah, a lot of people generally are risk takers. But what the forces thrive on, what they depend on, and I saw that some brigadier talking about it years ago, said the army depends on people with high levels of risk-taking behavior. Because they need you to employ you. Because if you're a bit more against taking risk, you're not likely to want to go in the forces in the first place. And if you do and you're a bit against, you're not likely to want to be the person that's going to go into a battle zone or get inside a tank which could be blown up or patrol the streets or stand on a gate. You're just not going to feel comfortable in that environment. So if you're comfortable taking risks with your life or your own personal safety, you're going to be comfortable in that job. And I think the problem that we face as people in the forces, once we're serving, that behavior is being addressed. It's being fed. You know, we go on tours. We go on adventure training just to satisfy that. We'll go abseiling, canoeing, skiing, parachuting, all these things which can address your risks. When we come out, we don't have that anymore. And that's where I came unstuck. It's when I came out of the army, I didn't have anything to address my risk-taking behavior, and which is why I ended up, you know, partly going down the route I did, because it kind of ticked that box, that one particular box I needed, which was essential for me to feel alive.
I mean, obviously the time you spent in Germany, did you get stationed anywhere else?
Yeah. So we did, as I said, Northern Ireland for 6 months in 1990, came back from there. When we came back, we disbanded the regiment because of defense cuts. Once the Berlin Wall came down in 1989, everything changed, so the army reduced its size, so there were disbandments, amalgamations. We then disbanded the 3rd Tanks, re-amalgamated with the 2nd to form the new 2nd World Tank Regiment. We reposted to Fallenbostel. That was in 92. 93, went off to Cyprus to do a UN tour, which was amazing. That was 6 months getting drunk and driving around in soft top Shoguns in the sun. It was great. I loved it. It was probably the best, I wouldn't say the best, but one of the more fun 6 months of my career. We worked the 9-day rota, 3 days on the gate, boring, 3 days on patrol, great. 3 days down in Iron Upper, even better. Yeah, and that was, we did that for 6 months solid. So I came back from that, and once I landed back in Germany, this was now in the summer of the early summer of 94. I looked at myself. I thought, do you know what? I've done Ireland as a tank regiment. I've done Ireland. I've done UN. Armored Corps don't get that many chances to do an operational tour. We missed the first Gulf War because we were in Northern Ireland at the time. I looked at my options and I thought that the army's not what it was. So I thought, you know what? I think the chance of me going out and doing an operational tour again is going to be unlikely. So I think I'm going to make my move and I'm going to get out. So I chose to get out. There was a woman involved. I thought, let's leave to make a relationship work. And promotion was slowed down because of these defence cuts. And a lot of my friends in Civvy Street, and bear in mind, I had this, I loved going back on leave to England and I love clubbing. They were all starting to get involved in a little bit of recreational use of drugs. So I saw a life which I was thinking, oh, that looks like fun as well. And I couldn't really mix the two. Couldn't really start going home and getting involved in that and being in the army because that just would not work at all. Although I did risk a few things. So I chose to get out. 1994, I signed my book off and I thought, that's it. I'm going to go. I'm going to bail out.
Did you have any other career path in mind when you did that?
Yeah, straight away. At the time in 94, I think early 95, there was a film, The Bodyguard, with Kevin Costner, Whitney Houston, massive hit. Saw that, looked at what I was eligible for with my career path and my service, and they give you a funding package. Within this catalogue, there was close protection course. I thought, that's the one for me. So I bailed out, went down to Maidstone about 3 or 4 months later. I think this was sort of early 95, and did a course of XSBS and CP work. And it was a great course, really good down in Maidstone. Learned a lot of really good stuff from them. And that was my new career path. I was going to be a bodyguard. And what I wasn't ready for was the fact that so many other veterans were going for the same sort of career. The market was flooded. I wasn't ready for that. There was a lack of jobs. The only way you would really have stood a chance of getting a job was to go overseas again and work doing the circuit, maybe over in Iraq or on the boats. And I just got back to England. I didn't really want to look at going somewhere again. I thought, I just want to be in the UK now. So I found a job doing surveillance with my dad, who'd left the police force, ex-police, ex-HMRC and ex-special forces. So we had a really good little team doing surveillance, which I really enjoyed. It was good. It was nearly full-time, which was, for me at the time, that was just perfect.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big jump, but at least you had something to go to. And I mean, you know, working again with your dad, I guess, was good.
It was nice because we distanced before joining the army. We had distance because I was becoming a little, I was getting up to no good. And I think he wasn't really happy with the direction I was taking. But the minute I said I was going to join the forces, he was so proud of me. And when he was always there for me, he supported me all the way through. He didn't support my choice on leaving the force. He said, you're a bit daft. You should stay in. I said, no, I've had enough. So when I came out working with Dad, it was nice. We had this little team going and it was lovely to work with my dad. You know, it was a good number. And it sort of rebuilt a relationship, which I think was missing between me and him. And as a result of that, we became even closer than we were before. It was good. Good job. You know, it was a little bit of a, how can I put it? Moments where surveillance could be extremely boring, but moments where it could be really exciting as well. But 90% of surveillance is sitting around just looking at a house or looking at a car, waiting for someone to move. But yeah, I loved it. It was just the perfect job, but it didn't address everything for me. It just ticked a couple of boxes. It just ticked employment, risk a little bit, but it didn't fulfill me. It wasn't fulfilling enough. I'd left so much behind. So much you leave behind in the forces, all your friends, your comrades. There's so many elements of your life which you don't think about when you get out. And when you realise that you only realise they're gone until you've left them behind. And you think, wow, I didn't realise I was going to suffer this much.
Any interesting surveillance jobs that you worked on that you can talk about?
Yeah, I mean, the vast majority of jobs we were doing were associated with people doing massive insurance claims, 50K plus. And this has gone back 25 years now, you know. So it was things like people saying they couldn't walk because they needed a stick. So we do a lot of this. And there are a number of kids. We did one where we followed some guy from somewhere in Wales over the bridge. We call it over the bridge. And the guy was saying he couldn't walk, couldn't do this. And he had a lot of different passions, including golf. So the guy on the van looked at him and this guy comes out of his house with a set of golf clubs on his back and thought, bingo, this guy's off to play golf. So plotted up. We followed him through the little Welsh mountains, found a tunnel. I think it was near Caerphilly, I think. Found the driving range. He went to the driving range and I thought, this is brilliant. We're going to get some footage here. So my boss said, look, go around the outside. There's a little hedge perimeter just bordering the side of this thing. So go over there, just climb on the fence and just film over the top of the edge of this guy. Bear in mind, cameras back then were this big. They weren't discreet little things. They were like the size of the thing you carry on your shoulder. So just film over there, get some footage and we can bin it. All right, no problem. So I ran across this field, climbed this little picket fence. You know, but I'm getting some good footage. I heard the sound of someone running. So I'm blinkered looking at this guy. I heard the sound of somebody running towards me. I thought, it's probably the boss, just to have a quick chat. Looked across, this big old lump coming at me. I thought, that's not my boss. So I climbed down, got the camera. He goes, what are you doing, mate? And I saw him just filming. He goes, who are you filming? And looked down, he's got this meat cleaver by the side of his hand. And he put, I said, whoa. So I got the camera, kept recording, dropped it down on the side. He's going to kill me. Let's get it on tape. And he's coming at me and he's raising it up. And I said, look, mate, what's the matter? He said, are you to do with the golf club? I said, no. I said, look, I said, tell you the truth, my dad's playing golf over there. He's got a competition with someone else. And he says he doesn't need no practice. So I'm just filming him. And I just winged it. And he said, so you don't play golf? I said, no. Like I said, he said, all right, not a problem, mate. And he walked off with his meat cleaver. And we spoke to him afterwards. What happened is basically the golfers have been slicing their balls into his field. He's the farmer. And they've been going over, hacking up his crops, trying to find their balls. And he had the ump with the club. So anything to do with the club, he was just basically on this mission to try and go out. I don't know if he's going to use the meat cleaver, but he looked pretty, like the intent was there. He had it raised. And I thought, talk fast, Rich, talk fast, get the guy down. But yeah, he calmed down. But he was a bit of a unit. But yeah, that surveillance isn't just watching people. It's about, you know, you've got to be aware of what's going on in your peripheral, because sometimes you can be so blinkered what you're doing. Another time, this is even worse. We found one guy, again in Wales, one old chap, he was claiming for, again, couldn't walk more than 100 metres. He's walking his granddaughter to school. So my boss says, go and plot him down there and start filming. Yeah, no problems. I sat and I got the camera filming him walking down the road. And I'm unaware at the time that I'm sat in the school lay-by. All the parents coming down. Next time, I'm having people bang, oh, you pedo. And I think, oh, my God, they think I'm filming the children. So I said, no, it's not what you think. So I sat the bug out quickly. I said, we've been compromised. We got to go. I was just filming this target. They thought I was filming the children. No, my God, no. I was mortified. I said, please, no. I was about to get lynched. So
what a nightmare. What a nightmare.
That's surveillance for you.
The bodyguard stuff's interesting as well. I mean, I did 18 years like working the doors in Newcastle and Spain and London, but I did some bodyguarding as well. And I mean, I enjoyed that. We did a lot of high profile people, across in Spain. I was looking after a lot of the DJs like Boy George and Tall Paul, and it was that kind of era, Brandon Block. Did you do any high profile bodyguarding?
Yeah, well, I did some work with Top Guard when I first came out. I didn't get as many jobs as I would have liked to have done, but the main link I had was Top Guard Security. And we did the Oasis Nebworth gig in 96.
Wow.
And we were backstage there looking after the Oasis guys and everyone else backstage. We were sort of like tasked, can you look after this person for the next 20 minutes? They want to go walk into the crowd. What, are you kidding me? So I got taken into the crowd to pick up Jarvis Cocker, who'd had far too many. This is just after the Michael Jackson thing. So he was big news at the time. So I had to go and escort him back out of the middle of the Nebworth crowd. 250,000 people, me and my Jack Jones. Said, come on, mate, we've got to go. He's got to call him Mr. Jarvis. He's not even called Mr. Jarvis, he's called Mr. Cocker. So I feel that, but that kind of exposed me in the VIP tent at the end of the two-day gig. It exposed me to things that were going on. And you've worked, you know, you've worked with the likes of these big DJs. You know what that era was like. You've seen what it goes on behind stage. And the DJ is probably the cleanest amongst them all. They're artists. But the people around and the things that are going on within that vicinity, I was exposed to that. And I wasn't ready for it, Steve. I wasn't ready to see the drug use in such...
I didn't understand that.
Oh, you got Siri. That's a classic.
She is such a nosy cow.
Siri and Alexa, they're a nightmare, mate. They're a nightmare.
I know.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, the drug taking behind the scenes in these things is rife. Yeah, you're right. And I mean, without naming names, it's an eye opener, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I wasn't ready for that. I was already clubbing at this stage, but this is 96. So for 95, I was already starting to take ecstasy on weekends. I was already kind of really getting pulled into that lifestyle, that culture. And then when I saw all these iconic people. And it really was wall to wall with people I'd seen on TV. And this is when Noel was going with Patsy. And you know, it was these faces. I think, Christ, I've seen these people on TV. I'm not saying that I witnessed them taking drugs. I didn't. But I'm saying the environment and the atmosphere that I was exposed to, I just wasn't ready to, I think, to mentally process that. Because it just, I think I was 25. It kind of, or 26, it kind of confused me a little bit of what's right from wrong. You know, this wavy line of like, what's right from wrong? Because all the things you do in the forces, you're encouraged to do, they're clearly illegal. You know, excess drinking, bullying, driving heavy machinery whilst potentially being drunk. You know, you just, that's how it was back in those days. And then to sort of come out and then try and sort of define what's right from wrong is really, really difficult. It's really hard to try. And it's not rocket science, but for me, it didn't feel like it was illegal. I didn't feel morally like I was breaking any laws, because morally, I was working for the army, walking around the streets of what looked like the UK, carrying a loaded gun. You know, when I was 20, and that has an impression on your psyche, it has an impression on you as a person, and how you perceive life and normality. And that's, for me, that kind of had an effect on me. It didn't mess me up, but it just had an effect on me, on my ability to sort of think, well, what's right, what's wrong? What, you know, it doesn't feel like it's wrong because I'm being told to do it. So when I come back to Civvy Street and I'm doing things which are clearly illegal, it didn't feel like I was breaking the law. I didn't have that moral connection that saying, you shouldn't do this, Rich. You shouldn't do this. And it was hard.
There's a perception, I guess. And I fully understand this, because we're you know, probably roughly the same age. We went through that same second summer of love, as we'll probably call it, you know, the ecstasy. I took ecstasy as a lad. To be honest, you know, the dance scene was fantastic in those days. And that's what took me to Ibiza. You know, I ran away from a relationship which had gone wrong, and I went and worked a summer in Ibiza. Best thing I ever did. You know, it helped me open my eyes to various things. But what I found out there was a lot of other people running away from their problems and their issues. And I came back and I sorted mine out, and that was that. But yeah, I mean, with your situation then, so you're in that predicament, you're seeing drugs being taken, you're partaking in drugs yourself. Is this where your life started to turn, Rich?
Yeah, I think it seemed to be such a gradual transition, if you like. And I didn't really feel myself taking a conscious decision to say, right, that's what I'm going to do. It just started off so small. And I've said this on other interviews where it was literally, I went and bought 5 pills for me and my friends because my other mate didn't want to do it anymore. I thought, let's go get these 5. And it just went from there, from 5 to 10, 100,000, 10,000, 50,000. It just went nuts. And that lifestyle was so interwoven into me because of that transition out of the forces. I had such a void in my life that whole culture just slipped into that void, and it filled it perfectly for all the wrong reasons. And the other thing as well, what people don't always realize, and this isn't me condoning ecstasy, is for me, when I took that pill, I could actually switch off for that hour and a half. My hypervigilance was so off the chart with doing surveillance, CP work. You know yourself, you're doing door, you're constantly like this, aren't you?
Yeah.
And with being in the forces, it's very hard to switch that off. And I find that when I was doing that, I switched it off. And I felt, just for the first time, I didn't care. I did not care about anything. I didn't care what happened next to me. There could be a fight 2 feet away. I wouldn't care. I was just going to keep dancing. And that's how it felt. And then for me, it was, I guess, like a form of, I guess, medication to kill off that hypervigilance, to allow me just to live a little bit for a little while. And that's what it did for me. And I guess that's why maybe I subconsciously was so attracted to that lifestyle. Maybe the fact it made me feel like I wasn't on edge, like I wasn't under threat, like I wasn't going to have to sort something out or deal with something. It didn't help in the end, because I got involved, so heavily involved in drug distribution, that I kind of created this world which was equally dangerous, or maybe more so than the forces. So when the ecstasy taking stopped, the hypervigilance came back in again, and it became an absolute a nightmare for your mental health, because you're switched on. You're constantly half-cocked, waiting for someone to go off. 15 years of waiting for trouble, waiting for the door to go off, waiting for the police, waiting for someone to rob you, waiting for someone to kill you, waiting for someone to kidnap your wife and kids because you didn't know what's going on. 15 years of waiting for that to happen.
Rich, it's a big jump. It's a big jump, mate. It's a big jump to go from buying 5 pills for your mates because one of your mates has decided he doesn't want to take them, to going into buying, you know, and supplying. I mean, how take us through that journey, mate, that transition, because was it the money? Was it the excitement? Was it I can buy them and make enough money to buy them, and then I'm not spending anything. What was it? There's got to be something.
Combination of all three. So for me, it wasn't about making money. It was about sort of the lads out, which we wanted. We wanted a night out. It wasn't. But with that, the byproduct was I got a free pill. Result, mm-hmm. as far as I'm concerned. So what we happened then is, well, we'd be in the club. We'd already be sorted. We'd dance and have a great time. People would think, oh, they're having a great time. They come up and say, oh, guys, you have you got anything? I say, no. And once you realise they're okay, I thought, I'll get something for next week. And it just kind of slowly progressed where within this club, I kind of built this little community around me. And I guess part of that was recreating that sense of belonging of what was missing from the forces. When I'd come on leave, all my friends would be very friendly, very welcoming, but I never quite fitted. I never quite belonged into that circle because I wasn't part of that circle anymore. I was just this little satellite on the outside. I'd dip in, say hello, do my thing, and I'd shoot off back to Germany again, come back in a few months, and I'd do the same again. I'd never really integrate into that society properly. So when I came out, buying and selling these pills created this culture around me. It made me feel like I was part of something again. And eventually the money didn't ever come with ecstasy. It always just covered a few nights out of the week. It covered the costs. We're giving away more than we should have sold. You know, we were given to all the doorman, the DJs, the light jocks, the bar staff, the managers. We had everything really well covered to ensure that club was as safe an environment as it could be for us to do what we did. So we didn't pay for drinks. We kind of spent a lot of money giving pills out, but we kind of recuperated that by saving costs on drinks and everything else. So I just kind of built this culture. And it wasn't until I think my wife, my then girlfriend, who is now my ex-wife, get that around the right way, we had our first son in 1999. That just changed everything. The minute she fell pregnant, that's it. No more clubbing. Get a job. Sort yourself out, Rich. And within her, she fell pregnant in February 1999. By March, I had a job. I had a job for 18 months. So I was just literally selling clubs, signing on, you know, just living the life of a small time drug dealer. And that's what it was. But as soon as my son came on the scene, I just changed and I stopped partying, I stopped clubbing. And that, for me then, it gave me clarity. I discovered Monday, Tuesday and Wednesday, which didn't exist previously because I was too busy relaxing or coming down or getting my faculties together after a heavy weekend. So these days I was working and then I maintained selling the drugs. I kept doing it. But because I was discovering these other days, I became more productive and that kind of increased sales. And then eventually moved into cocaine in about 2002 because the pill market had crashed. Everyone that was doing it was moving into the bars. They started to do things differently. So I kind of think, well, okay, let's evolve with this lifestyle, with this culture. This is where it's moving. And that's where it ended up. That's where it moved into cocaine in 2002. And that's when it got really problematic. It's a horrible industry, horrible.
Okay, so it's, you know, with ecstasy, it's about partying, it's about going out, about supplying your friends and, you know, saving yourself a few quid, making a little few quid. You see the light when you have a family, but going into cocaine, as you say, it's a different world altogether. Suddenly, you're entering the world of gangsters.
Yeah, which I wasn't ready for. I mean, I've been kind of already exposed to people in the ecstasy industry. They are there, but it's a very, very calm environment. People aren't kicking your door off for a couple of grand because you're a little bit late. You take on X amount of cocaine and that costs 10 times more than you ever had before. You all of a sudden you're going from a bill of, say, 3 or 4 grand to a bill of 30 or 40 grand. So with the numbers increasing, so does the risk of the profit margin. So do the people that you're working with. And it's a really difficult journey to navigate through that world, finding people that are like-minded, non-violent, business-minded, and aren't going to want to kill you if you're late because most people are late. It's just the nature of the game. People are late. The way that industry works is people go crazy on the weekend. They have no intention of paying their bill. And as that sort of creates this ripple upwards or the ripple downwards to the the distribution network, it focuses back up as you go up, and that problem becomes greater and greater. And the money seems to, the money's coming in, but it's getting, by the time it's got to get to me at this level, there's not a great deal there. You're thinking, right, I'm still 20K short of this 60 grand bill. And you're thinking, they're coming out of hundreds, you know, and that's the nature of the game. That's how it is. And because I wasn't a violent individual, I had to navigate through these people taking losses, but I wasn't prepared to get lifed off or done for kidnap or that sort of, because that just wasn't me. I wasn't interested in the violent aspect of it. I preferred to go through it as a business. Eventually you find the right people and you conduct yourself in the same manner as they do. And it's an extremely civilized industry to be in when you got the right people. It doesn't mean there aren't people around you which are there to support you if it's necessary. But at the time, by the point of my arrest, it was going really well. And I guess that's why we got arrested, because we kind of popped above a certain threshold of a radar, and then we became a problem for the police. And all of a sudden, you know, the eyes are on you, if you like, and they think, right, let's take this guy down. He's due out. Let's have him. And that's where it ended up.
What kind of levels were you playing at here? I mean, you know, there's a difference, you know, between buying, as I say, you know, 100 ecstasy pills or buying a kilo of cocaine. What levels were you at, Rich?
Well, I was convicted on 22 kilos. So, but that wasn't based on a week. That was based on an estimation of a certain amount of journeys to and from London by my supplier. On average, I guess it could have been any from as little as nothing, because it's a dry week, to maybe 10 kilos a week. It could have varied. And it's not, some of it was going out in its original format. Some of it wasn't, depended on the buyer. It was a buyer's market at the time. There was major droughts in 2010, really bad. The prices had gone ridiculously through the roof. You're talking about 60K for a kilo of pure cocaine. And even that wasn't really pure. It wasn't what I was used to. So the market was beginning to become flooded with people. The same way the ecstasy market had gone in the late 90s, cocaine was going the same way. Everyone was bashing the hell out of it. Everybody was remixing all sorts of wonderful things to try and get as much money back as they could. And I think during certainly 08, 09 and 10, the purity levels had dropped significantly. And again, it was the same thing. You were just thinking, well, this isn't going anywhere. I could see the end of it. I could see the end of that. That industry, as far as I was concerned, was dying its death. So for me, it was to think, right, it's time for an exit strategy. This is good. This has got a shelf life now. And it's going to end. It's not going to end well. So I need to get out of it and find something. So I found motorsport in 2008. And I was building up frantically during 08, 09 and 10 to try and get on my way. And the trouble is, during a recession as well. So it's very hard to try and make a new business succeed in a recession when everyone else is failing. So that's really hard. It's sign of the times. It was difficult anyway.
Yeah. I mean, you know, again, it's the gangster situation. Did you have any rivals? Did you have any hairy moments in your build up your arrest?
Yeah, some I can't really talk about, but there's always going to be a problem of some sort, and there's always going to be violent people of some sort. Now, within my conspiracy, within my co-defendants, there were incidents happening which related to them, which were involving people getting held up with shotguns and being robbed. You know, literally people jumping out of cars with shotguns and, you know, not so much shooting at them, but holding them at gunpoint to try and rob them. So things were happening. Things were getting really hairy for some point. And there's always going to be people out to try and rob you in some way or other. But luckily you get to a certain point and people just presume that if you're at a certain level, that it's not wise to just rob you. So I was really lucky. I'd navigated through this really treacherous minefield. And I'd managed to sort of like deal with all the problems. And the only real time they came when it's going to be potentially life-threatening. And I said this before, it's like, it was a minor deal for, I think, about a quarter of a kilo in this guy's flat. And we went in there, we did the deal, it was cash. I dropped it off to the guy. We tested it, it's okay. The guy rang and said, this is no good. I said, what do you mean it's no good? It's no good. It's not what you've told me. It's a low percentage. It's like a 30% rather than a 70. So okay, no problem. Oh, God, this guy's going to be arbitrary. He's not a negotiator. This guy, he's a hitter. He's going to want to have a scrap first, then deal with it afterwards. So I thought, let's go in anyway and see what happens. So walked into the flat. He knew I was coming. He had two other lads sat in his lounge. Walked in. I said, look, mate, sorry, but this ain't really what it's meant to be. He said, the part we tested may well have been, but the rest of it, it's no good. He looked at it and said, that's not what I gave you. I said, well, it is. He said, well, no, it's not. I said, well, it is, mate. He said, look, where are we going with this? And on the wall to my left, to his right, he stood between me and the door. There's a meat cleaver on the door. Me and meat cleavers. Is it someone in Wales or someone in Bristol? And he's looking at this meat cleaver, and I'm looking at it thinking, if he reaches for that, all the training in the world, because this guy's a pretty good boxer as well, I thought, this is going to get messy. So look, mate, let's just not get carried away with this. What don't you think is right? So I negotiated through what we did. I said to him, look, do you believe that some of this is yours? He said, yeah, that solid brick there, that's what I gave you. All that loose stuff, I ain't having that back. So I said, all right, then, no problem. So look, you pay me back for the loose, for the brick, the lump. I'll retain the loose stuff. I'll resell it and I'll pay you back for it. Yeah, no problem. So we refunded the money for the bit, which is about five. I think it cost about $7,000 at the time. He refunded about five. I went off with the $2,000 worth, sort of a two and a half, paid his money. I had $500 profit, job done. So just negotiate way out of it. But it was really close. You could see that he was ready to go. And I thought, if it goes, he's got two lads in the front room as well. He's got a meat cleaver on the wall, which is there for a reason. This is going to get really messy. So luckily I can talk. And I sort of like negotiated the way out of it. And luckily, I didn't go back there again. I thought, I'm not dealing with him again. It's just going to be headaches. And that was it. So really, considering the length of time I was involved in that industry, I was really lucky to get through it and not have to come out of any serious injury. Apart from when
I mean, yeah, go on, sorry.
Yeah, apart from in the book, in the early chapters, I am attacked by someone who's got an axe to grind. You know, it basically in all names change, certain things change, but this guy had been sent down for 18 months or so. He'd messed up, he got on the juice while I was inside, he came out with an axe to grind, and he wanted to grind that axe with me. So he turned up to my place of work, which was in the book, it was a car parts stand, with these two or three other lads. And I thought, oh god, this is going to be bad news, because one of the guys there, he's called Cy in the book, I can't beat this guy. You know, so next, you know, they're steaming into me, and there's all sorts of stuff getting thrown at me. And that was about the closest I had where I thought I'm going to get hurt, because the real situation was much more severe, which I can't really say on air. But what actually happened was much worse than what happened in the book. I could say it when it's not being recorded, but I can't put it on air. But it put it this way, I was that far from being dead. It was close.
Wow.
It was close. So, yeah, but I'm still here.
So, I mean, you were a key part of a gang that smuggled an estimated £3 million of cocaine from London to Gloucestershire and Bristol, yeah, for distribution, right, across the southwest and Wales. So, I mean, from your perspective, what was it like when the doors finally went in? Was it a relief to be at the end of this, you know, period of your life?
Yeah, 100%, Steve. I knew that it was coming. And people say, oh, why didn't you run? Why didn't you do this? By then, I had a wife and two sons. I'm not running from anyone. If it's kind of come on top, I accept what happens and I do my best to look at damage limitations. So when they came to my garage, the garage was open. The motorsport was up and running. Dream was set. Exit strategy had been executed. I was out the door. I hadn't just quite closed the door behind me. And I sat in my garage, looked through the entrance to the reception, to the sort of concrete hard standard where we park the cars in the summer. And I seen the cars turn up and I knew straight away that it was the police. And I thought, this is it, I'm done. So I just walked out and said, good morning. And I just felt, when they arrested me, I just felt, oh. And so a lot of people involved in crime say that feeling. When they sat in the back of the car, I was being taken to the police station for an interview. And I thought, I'm so glad it's done. I'm so relieved that it's finally it's finished. Because I knew then, conscious decision was, that's it, it's done. I'm out, I'm finished. No matter what happens now in the future, I'm not going back to that. My fate has been sealed. I've been nicked for it. And it's such a relief. It was so nice. I'm not saying nice, but it was just such a weight off my shoulders to finally accept the fact that it's done, it's dusted. It was lovely. Lovely. Nicest moment of being arrested.
What was the court case like, you know, being in the dock? And I mean, you know, were you optimistic or were you resigned to your fate?
Oh, pure stupidity. I ran trial. I had two charges of conspiracy against me. So I was the only one in all 13 co-defendants, the only one with two charges. I was the link between Op Kestrel, which was mine, and Op Berlin, which was my co-defendants. And I was the link between the two. So they were fighting the amount of court appearances we had to decide, what do we do with Mr. Jones? Do we do severance, i.e. two separate trials, or joined, or one big trial? And they argued that what was going to be in the benefit of the CPS, what's in the benefit of my defence. We ended up with severance. So basically, I'd sit on one trial with two counts of conspiracy against me with seven of us all together. Was it seven? No, five, sorry. My apologies, five of us on trial at the time. And it was just, it was my stupid mentality is I just found it really exciting and very interesting to be sat in court. It was very surreal. It didn't feel like I was the one on trial. It was like watching it from the public gallery. And I kept forgetting I wasn't in the public gallery. I'm actually in the dock. I'm actually the one under trial. And then it became real when they mentioned my name. And they started, let's talk about Mr. Jones. I thought, oh, yeah, I am in court. Yeah, this is about me. And when you see the jury bundle, which is all the information that the CPS have put together, and you see all the cell site for the first time, and you look at it and you think, my solicitor lied to me. He told me I had a good chance. I looked at this. I think if I was a jury member, I would find me guilty straight away based on the strength of that cell site. I just knew I was in trouble. I thought, this is it, but it's too late. I can't plead now because I'm already sat in the dock. I'm not going to get any time off. It's going to look stupid. So let's just roll the dice and see how it goes. And it was just really interesting to see how the delivery of the CPS to be sat there and witness how can I put it? I won't use the word corruption doesn't come into mind, but the word guided by the judge, guided by the CPS, the amount of times that you when you finish and you bell to go home that night and you go and you go into the pub for a drink with your brief and your barrister to debrief. Next table, you've got the CPS and the investigating police sat there, and they're all, oh, how are you doing? You think, yeah, I know what's going on here. This is so bad. And you're thinking to yourself, how many deals are they cracking under the table there? They're all sat in the same chambers. They're all talking about things. We know it goes on. You just don't realize it until you actually see it. And for me, I just thought to myself, well, I am lying out of my backside to get through this trial. I don't expect them to do the same. Because if they don't make things up or don't, how can I put it, paint a different picture, they won't get a conviction. They got to do what's necessary to get that conviction. And that's what they did. And they got one not guilty, one guilty, which was the right result. I was found not guilty on count one, guilty on count two, which was spot on. You know, that's where it should have been. But yeah, it was an interesting exercise of my, I guess my willpower of thinking, like, what's going on here? How do I deal with this? Going into the box was really exciting because a day of being grilled by the CPS, you know, really giving a good grilling. I really enjoyed that because it was risky. It was that risk again. I couldn't wait to get in there. When I came out, I was buzzing. I thought, that was great. And my brief said, yeah, you did all right. You did okay. You messed up a couple of times, but you did okay. So I just enjoyed the process because I knew where it was going to end up. Why sit there miserable and hating it when I know I'm going to go to prison anyway? So let's just make the most of it and just enjoy it as best I can.
Were you ready for prison?
Yeah, in a sense, I was ready for it. Mentally, you can't get involved in crime for that long and not mentally prepare yourself for prison. You can't. And if you don't, you're stupid. To people that, if someone goes into prison after a career in crime and is shocked that they're there, they're just underestimating the police and the capabilities and the resources that they've got. I was fully prepared for it. However, what I wasn't ready for was the fact that my family weren't. My missus, well, my ex wasn't. My kids certainly weren't. Neither was my dad or my mum or anyone that loved me. They weren't ready for me to go to prison. I was kitted up. I was ready. Let's go. This is going to be great. I'm going to go in there and sort myself out, write a book, get fit. I didn't think one minute I would affect them. And that's where I think people underestimate the damage of going away. They don't think for one minute how it's going to affect their, especially your kids. It really had a very, very detrimental effect on my kids, especially my youngest. Now, we were okay. Things are okay with him now. He was in a bad place for a very long time. And he suffered greatly because of it.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, you know, you got into the way of prison life. You decided, obviously, that this wasn't going to be the end of you, but it was going to be the beginning of you. And you set about writing your own course called Project TLC, which just stands for the Lost Soldier.
Yeah, TLS. Yeah, so yeah, absolutely. So I was a veterans rep for 5 years in HMP Oakwood and identified that the problem veterans face was transition. And I knew that because I suffered the same problems myself. So I spoke to the people in charge. So are there any courses for veterans? We have to address our offender behavior. So, but there's nothing there. And they said, no, there's nothing. So right, I'm going to, with permission, can I write one? I said, go on. Yeah, crack on. They're not thinking I was going to do it. And within 3 months, I wrote Project TLS, a 12-module course. And within a month after that, I was delivering it to veterans in custody in the prison, and that continued for 3 years until the day of my release. So yeah, TLS was a great success, and I'm currently talking with prisons now to get it back in. It was due to go in 2 years ago, but COVID kind of held that up, obviously. So it's due to, we're looking at talks now to try and get back in the prison. So fingers crossed, TLS will be back in the prisons and supporting veterans who some shouldn't be in prison. There's some young lads who struggle. I'm not going to say the older guys. Some younger lads there who've had a really poor transition. They've seen some terrible things overseas, and they've just not had the transition they should have had. They've not had the support from the forces, and they've fallen foul of the CGS, and they've ended up inside as a result of it. And I think had they got a better transition, a bit better support, they wouldn't be in prison. Half of them wouldn't be in jail. I can guarantee it.
I like the way you described it, and you described yourself as a weapon that hadn't been decommissioned properly.
Yeah, yeah. There was this ex-SAS guy. He turned to be a barrister, and he's got this analogy of saying that when you've got a weapon of mass destruction, you decommission it, or you take out the working parts, you remove the firing pin, the explosives, you make that weapon safe. And then you can put that weapon somewhere, and it's not a problem anymore. It won't hurt anyone. At no point were any of us decommissioned. We were not made safe. I'm not saying necessarily violent, but we were not decommissioned from our time in the forces. We weren't trained to be civilians. We weren't trained to fit in the community. We were trained to go somewhere else and do different things. They did not decommission me. They did not decommission a lot of guys that come out. And that's what the problem is. And they think they are. They think they're addressing, but they're falling so way short of the mark of what they should be doing. And that's what I'm trying to do now is create that awareness through social media, through the book, through my own podcast. I'm trying to do what I can to try and help people to understand that the journey we take as veterans, we struggle when we come out of the forces. And that's where our problems start. And that's the thing about prison. Prison trains you really well to be a part of the community. So you bounce out of prison, out of the forces into community as a veteran, you don't fit. You go into prison, I got decommissioned in prison, and I came out and I felt like a part of the community again. It's liberating. It's really nice just to be part of that something. I felt like I fit. I felt like I belonged for the first time in 30 years.
Charlie 4Kilo is available, obviously, on Kindle. It's got a 5-star rating, over 325 ratings, and it's done really well. I mean, I personally think this should be made into a film, and hopefully that is something that's going to happen at some point for you. But, I mean, where was the inspiration for the book, Rich?
Well, I kind of sort of flirted with the idea of different ideas that I had no idea what to write. I knew I was going to do a book. I thought, well, I may as well. That was my plan B. If I get caught, go to prison, write a book. So I kind of looked at different options, and I thought to myself, well, let's just tell the story of my life, and let's do it in parts, because I thought it's too much to put it'd be like an encyclopedia. You just switch off after fight. It'd be too big and too heavy. So let's do three parts, and even then the part two was too big, so I had to split it in the middle again. So I've got a four-part series, and it starts at part two. If anyone does buy it, there is no part one yet. That's going to be a prequel. And I thought, I'm going to start it at this point because this is when things are really leery. There's a lot going wrong in my life. It's about 15 years ago. I've been involved in the coke industry for, let's say 4 or 5 years. And I'm in the thicket with some complete idiots. People that are just, this minefield I was navigating my way through. I'm still navigating my way through this minefield. I'm in the middle of this minefield. And it's surrounded by people with just different characters, explosive characters, people that are unpredictable, and people whose problems, whose behavior has a seriously detrimental effect on my own journey. And C4K is based on something going wrong in someone else's life where it has a ripple effect, and it has catastrophic effects on my life and my business, putting me in debt to about 80 grand on tick for coke. And it's the things I got to do to try and recover that money and survive. And part two, C4K, just really starts that off. Part three, overseas operations, is going to be focused on me looking at working overseas, obviously, with maybe the cartels. You know, who knows? I could leave it in the book and let people read it to find out. But that is, it's a belter. I started writing it, and it will be out this year, but it's going to be good. And it's all based on the truth. I can't say it's a true account, can I? Because that could be really dangerous. So it's based on the truth.
Well, that's good. That's what all books are like that, which is great. And look, from your perspective, it sounds like things are going well. You've embraced social media as well. You're on TikTok, aren't you? I think the last count, over 50,000 followers. You've probably got a lot more now. The Lost Soldier on there as well.
Yeah, it's a really interesting journey. But the thing with TikTok is this is my backup account. I lost my main account about a month ago. 65,000 followers gone, just like that. So I've rebuilt the first 57,000 now. I've got to throw in the old controversial post at risk of bans because it needs that momentum. The algorithm is a confusing creature, the algorithm on there. And sometimes you've got to throw caution to the wind and do posts which people will be upset with. But that's the nature of the game. That's the world I'm living in. But social media has just become such a beast since I came out of prison. It's just unreal. TikTok, I just thought I'd have a little bit of fun. And I saw a few veteran creators on there and I thought, oh, hang on a minute. Maybe I can sort of like talk about my journey. And I spoke about the army and I didn't really get much following. I thought, oh, yeah. So I mentioned drugs and that was it. Bang. People know I mentioned prison. Wow. The followers went completely bonkers. And I thought, oh, okay, I get it now. I get it. It's that morbid fascination of that world, that veil that is drawn between the underworld, if you like, and the real world. People don't ever go on the other side of it, but they'd love to look through it, don't they? Just take a little peek and see what it's all about. And I think I've just opened the veil up and I've drawn it pretty wide open. I've exposed myself, no one else. I'm happy to put my heart on my sleeve and say, look, this is what I've did. I'm not condoning it. I'm not exposing anyone else. I'm saying this is what I did. And if you think it's a secret, I got arrested, so it's not a secret. I'm not giving up any trade secrets. I'm not giving any names up, not giving any locations away. But some people say, oh, you got to be careful what you say. Why? I got arrested, mate. I got done for it. The police already know. And if someone's practicing these methods, have a rethink, mate, because it doesn't work. It doesn't work out. So, yeah, it's a really great, it's a really interesting tool to use for business alone. It's great. I love it. It's very consuming, yeah, though.
It is very common. You've got to learn again to switch off your devices. The true crime genre as well is something which, you know, as you say, it's escapism for people. That's what it is. People love that little bit of danger, but as long as they don't have to get their hands dirty and be involved. Last couple of questions. Yeah. First of all, you know, any regrets?
I get asked this so many times, Steve, and I've got to say, no, I've got a regret. I regret not being around for my children. I knew what dad wouldn't regret that, but I have to take the whole thing as one big package of everything that I've done from 18 through the forces into the CP, with the experiences I've seen, the life skills I've gained. All that negativity from the drugs world is now a positive aspect for me. Time in prison to reboot myself, come out. Kids are good. As long as I'm doing what I'm doing, I'm moving in the direction I'm going in, I've got no regrets. I cannot regret anything because then I'm regretting what I'm trying to do now. So it's all part of that rich tapestry of life, isn't it? It's created this picture which people can look at now and think, okay, pretty dark there, but look how bright it is now. So I can't regret any of it. No, I can't. I'm not going to regret it. No, that sounds bad. And I've been to recovery conferences. I stood in a room full of over 200 or 300 recovering addicts and I've talked about my journey and I'm willing to stand up and be counted for my offense and my crime and not one person blame me for anything. And these are the people whose opinions matter to me, the people that have suffered at the end of what I've done. And I'm willing to stand and I attend every year, albeit by Zoom. I attend every year and I will keep on attending to these conferences. And I'll talk to these people about my journey, their journey, and how a lot of things we come hand in hand. My addiction was risk. Their addiction was a substance. We were both feeding each other's risk or each other's addiction subconsciously. And I think as long as I'm doing the right thing by my experience, I can't regret what I've done. I have to keep moving forward and stay positive about my journey.
Any message to a young person who may be thinking about going down that road of getting involved in drugs? They see the fast cars, they see the jewellery that you can get from all this money that you're making from literally other people's misery. Any message to somebody who's thinking about going down that road?
Yeah, play the long game. Don't look at what you can have right now, because you're not going to get that right now, because the misery and stress and the effect it has on your mental health by stepping into that world. And when you initially start that work, start off, you'd be a young single person with no responsibilities like I was. and you dive into it head first and you think this is great, you've got all your stuff around you, you meet someone, you have some kids, and then you go to prison. And also what you haven't realized is all through that journey, you've been preparing yourself for this end game prison, but you've forgotten along the way you picked up responsibilities like children, family, people that you care about, a house, all these things that these people depend on. And you won't think that now. You won't see that now because it hasn't happened yet, but it will happen. The best way to do it is to actually get a normal job, work hard, and build things around you slowly like everyone else does. And I see people now in my job still doing removals with a good friend of mine until my thing takes off. I see people going into houses and they're so happy. They're so stressed by moving, but they're so glad they finally got to that moment in life that they've worked hard for. And you can see the fact they're loving life and they don't have to worry about it. If you acquire all that stuff through criminal activity, you may as well just say it's temporary, because it is. It will go. It'll be taken off you. And all you've got left there is your misery and nothing and a cell. So don't do it. Just stay away from it. You can look me up. I'll talk to anyone. I'll advise anyone. I'll have a private chat with anyone who thinks they're going down that road. And I'll give you enough stories to make you change your mind within a few minutes. And it's happening on social media. People do a U-turn so quickly once I tell them a few stories. So, yeah.
Rich, it's an inspirational story. It's a great message to finish with. The Lost Soldier, Rich Jones, is available on social media. Give him a reach out if you are feeling tempted. And please buy his book, Charlie 4 Kilo. You can buy it on Kindle or you can buy a hard copy on Amazon. And the link is below. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thanks for coming on. Best of luck with the second book and hopefully get you on when that one comes out as well, mate.
Yeah, thank you, Steve. Appreciate your time.
No worries. Take care. Bye-bye. Thanks to all our sponsors, SpiderVPN for all your internet security. Google SpiderVPN. They come up at the top of the Google search list. They are the boys to trust and will protect your computer from unwanted bugs. Skipsandbins.com, telephone 0800 25 45 25 3, email inquiries at skipsandbins.com, website www.skipsandbins.com. Easy contract, free and pay-as-you-go waste collection. Thanks also to L&G Family Funeral Directors, 0191 389 7245, and to Garden of Healing Dispensary, CBD Hemp and Cannabinoid Specialists, www.gohd.com. Thanks also to Arcot Interiors for all your kitchen necessities. You can find them at the bottom of Heaton Road. And Google Arcot Interiors, they come up at the top of the Google search list. Thanks also to qtechshop.co.uk, the makers of pool tables and snooker tables in Wallsend, Newcastle. And the guys who run our website, nufcmatters.com. Thanks also to jabsignature.co.uk for all of the flyers that they do for us. Thanks to Media Arts for all the video work. If you're a first-time visitor to the channel, please subscribe. Hit the Newcastle Legends logo in the bottom right-hand corner, and that's it. You can subscribe for free. We still do 7 shows a week, and they are all free. Hit the thumb up underneath the video to like it. Click share to share to your social media, and drop into the comments box to speak to like-minded Newcastle fans. We're also available as a podcast on iTunes and Spotify and other podcast providers. The show usually goes up 24 hours after the show. If you want to join the NUFC Matters cult and get a cup, a pen, a scarf and your membership card and entry into the monthly draw, put your phone over this QR code and it will take you straight to the website. Failing that, go to nufcmatters.com and become a member. If you want to come and see Malcolm McDonald pre-match or post-match, we are at the Dog and Parrot. It's kid-friendly and it goes great food and beer, and you can come and meet Malcolm in person before the match or after the match during the season. Make a donation to the food bank via nufcfansfoodbank.co.uk. The match day bucket is operational 365 days of the year. If you want to follow us on social media, then go to NUFC Matters. We've got a Facebook group and we've got a Facebook page. And if you're into the true crime stuff that we do, then follow Steve Raitt's True Crime Interviews, and that is a Facebook group. My personal Twitter following page is @Steve Raitt, and Instagram is Steve Raitt. Give me your follow on there too.